Today is Monday, June 8th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 32 to 35 minutes, we'll cover the collapse of the U.S.-Iran diplomatic framework following renewed IRGC missile strikes on Gulf states, Ukraine's unprecedented long-range drone campaign reaching St. Petersburg and Moscow, and the structural tensions freezing a Bangladesh-India bilateral reset. Let's begin with Iran, where what had briefly looked like a diplomatic off-ramp has now closed, at least for the moment. The confrontation between the United States and Iran has moved through at least three distinct phases since hostilities began. First came a 38-day bombing campaign, then came a window of nearly 50 days of negotiation, and now, according to a transcript of the Victor Davis Hansen interview on the Jill Michaels program, we are in a third phase, one marked by renewed IRGC offensive action. On June 3rd, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps launched ballistic missiles and drones targeting Kuwait and Bahrain. According to that same Hansen interview, multiple projectiles penetrated air defenses and struck the passenger terminal at Kuwait International Airport, resulting in one fatality and 63 injuries. It's worth noting that those casualty figures come from the program's host and carry no independent institutional citation, so treat them as preliminary. Iran's framing of those strikes is significant. Tehran declared that the ceasefire with the United States was, in their words, completely off. The stated provocation was a prior Persian Gulf skirmish involving a downed U.S. drone and subsequent U.S. retaliatory strikes on Iran's Karg Island, per the Hansen interview. But Hansen makes a crucial analytical distinction here. The IRGC directed its missiles at Gulf states, hosting U.S. military bases, not at U.S. forces directly. He characterizes this as reflecting Iran's severely limited remaining direct action options, a significant shift in the strategic balance from just a few months ago. To understand how we arrived at this rupture, we need to go back briefly to late May. President Trump had announced what senior officials described as an agreement in principle. Under that framework, Iran would dispose of its enriched uranium stockpiles in exchange for the United States lifting its naval blockade and reopening the Strait of Hormuz, according to the Hansen interview. It was a substantial offer, and it collapsed. Iran suspended the peace talks, citing escalating Israel-Hezbollah fighting in Lebanon as its stated pretext. What followed was diplomatically revealing. Trump subsequently called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and, according to an Axios report cited in the Hansen transcript, acknowledged describing Netanyahu as crazy. That's a striking phrase from a sitting American president about one of Washington's closest allies, and it strongly suggests the administration privately blamed Israeli military operations for derailing what had been a promising diplomatic track. As of the time of recording, peace talks were described as on life support. Hansen's broader assessment of Iran's strategic position is worth spending some time on, because it frames why the IRGC's June 3rd strikes, while disruptive, represent a weakened hand rather than a show of strength. He describes Iran's proxy network as having been systematically degraded. Hamas, in his assessment, is basically finished. The Houthis are significantly deterred following Israeli and American warnings. That leaves Iran with two active cards, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the capacity to harass the Strait of Hormuz. Both are consequential, but neither represents the kind of multi-front pressure Iran could credibly threaten 12 or 18 months ago. On the economic dimension, Hansen cited approximately $400 million in daily oil output losses and described gasoline queues 3 or 4 miles long in some cases, alongside food shortages inside the country. He placed the cumulative loss of nuclear, industrial, and military investment accumulated over 50 years at approximately $500 billion. These figures are attributed to Hansen himself and no named institutional source, but they paint a picture of a regime under severe domestic economic strain. Perhaps the most notable external assessment came from Condoleezza Rice, identified in the Hansen interview and in a separate commentary transcript as director of the Hoover Institution. Rice, characterized in both sources as a critic of the Trump administration rather than a partisan supporter, is cited as having written that the United States has done more damage to the Iranian regime than any actor in 50 years. That's a significant statement from someone with her credibility and political positioning, even if neither transcript reproduces her analysis directly or names the publication. On energy markets, the picture is more stable than the headlines might suggest. Hansen cited approximately 200 tankers positioned across the Mediterranean, Red Sea, and Gulf, each carrying between 1 million and 2 million barrels of oil, representing roughly 5 days of global oil supply. That inventory buffer has been the primary reason the Strait of Hormuz crisis hasn't produced an acute market shock. Building on that, Hansen described incremental production increases from multiple sources, approximately 300,000 additional barrels from Russia, up to 300,000 from Venezuela, and approximately 500,000 from expanded U.S. output, with American production described as approaching 14 million barrels per day. Oil prices were reported near $100 per barrel at the time of recording, elevated, but attributed to market uncertainty rather than actual supply disruption. Former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, interviewed on the Rubin Report, cited a 14-cent decline in U.S. domestic gasoline prices in the prior week, attributing it to the administration's Iran strategy. He offered no external source for that figure. On the legislative front, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bipartisan concurrent resolution on June 4th to constrain Trump's war powers, with four Republicans crossing party lines, per the Hansen interview. House Speaker Mike Johnson warned the vote would weaken Trump's negotiating leverage with Tehran. Hansen's assessment of the resolution's practical effect is notably skeptical. He argues that the 38-day bombing campaign has already concluded, and that any new military action would effectively reset the statutory 60-day clock provided under the War Powers Act anyway. He cited historical precedent, Bill Clinton's 72-day bombing campaign in Serbia and Barack Obama's 7-month campaign in Libya, neither of which ever received formal War Powers Act authorization from Congress. The resolution's symbolic weight, in other words, may outrun its operational bite. The Senate's trajectory on this measure remains the key near-term variable. Now to Ukraine, where the story of the first 5 months of 2026 is one of measurable Ukrainian momentum, on the battlefield, in the air, and inside Russia itself. Let's start with the territorial picture. According to the Institute for the Study of War, cited in Source 3, Russia was advancing approximately 7 square miles of Ukrainian territory per day in December 2025. By February 2026, that trajectory had reversed. Ukraine was recording net territorial gains for the first time since July 2023. More granular data comes from Dr. Jason Smart, Kyiv Post special correspondent, cited in Source 5. In the first 5 months of 2026, Russian forces gained 104 square kilometers, roughly 40 square miles. But they lost control of approximately 281 square kilometers, roughly 109 square miles. The net deficit for Russia, 177 square kilometers. That's not a tactical setback. That's a strategic inversion. Smart's reporting situates Russian casualties within a striking historical framework. Russia's current loss density is approximately 77% of the casualty density recorded at the Battle of the Somme, which Smart cites at 1,852 casualties per square kilometer. It's approximately 12% below the density recorded at Avdiivka, approximately 40% below the density at Bakhmut, and nearly 19 times the casualty density Germany sustained during its 1918 Operation Michael. To put all of that in plain terms, Russia is absorbing losses at a rate that has few modern historical parallels, and those losses are occurring on ground it is now losing rather than gaining. The operational tempo of destruction is equally striking. Nearly 8 Russian military transport vehicles are being destroyed per hour, per Smart's reporting. And General Sirsky is cited as identifying approximately 140,000 Russian troops deployed in the direction of Huliaipol and Oleksandrovka, most described as lacking basic supplies. Russia's 36th Army is specifically reported to be rationing artillery shells and compelling civilians and commercial vehicles to transport fuel. That is a logistics system under serious strain. Amid all of this, Robert Madyar Bravdi, commander of Ukraine's unmanned systems forces, offered a data point that deserves particular attention. Drones represent 2% of Ukraine's military, he said, but account for one-third of all targets destroyed. A force multiplication ratio of that scale has no clear modern precedent. That brings us to Ukraine's long-range drone operations, arguably the most consequential military development in this reporting period. Ukraine's Ministry of Defense stated that the Moscow region experienced its largest drone attack since the start of the full-scale invasion on the night of May 17, 2026. Ukrainian officials stated this was the first time Ukrainian forces had successfully struck the Moscow oil refinery in Kapotnia, the Sonikorsk fuel base, and several microelectronics production facilities, targets previously considered heavily protected by Russian air defense. In mid-May, Ukraine launched 600 long-range drones at Moscow in what Source 3 describes as one of the largest such attacks of the war. But the strike on St. Petersburg may prove even more strategically significant. A Ukrainian drone traveled over 1,000 kilometers, approximately 620 miles, into Russian territory, prompting evacuation orders on the outskirts of St. Petersburg and reports of a fire at the Kronstadt Naval Arsenal. The Astro-Telegram channel reported a major fire at Kronstadt, which hosts the Baltic Fleet Naval Base and the Kronstadt Marine Plant. Drones also targeted the village of Liby in the Leningrad region, reportedly striking an ammunition depot identified as the Novice 15 Arsenal. The official Russian response was notable for what it revealed. Leningrad Governor Alexander Drozdanov claimed 88 drones were intercepted, while simultaneously acknowledging the raid was still ongoing when he made that statement. St. Petersburg Mayor Alexander Beglov officially confirmed a large-scale attack. And Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova, rather than acknowledging the strikes at all, posted an image of a sunny sky over St. Petersburg on Telegram. The information management was visible and, by any measure, not particularly convincing. The timing of the St. Petersburg strikes was deliberate. They coincided with the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, described by Atlantic Council editor Peter Dickinson as Putin's Davos. Dickinson assessed this targeting as potentially one of the most significant symbolic attacks of the entire war. Ukraine wasn't just hitting infrastructure. It was hitting the stage Putin uses to project Russia's image as a functioning, globally connected economy. Zelensky amplified the moment further. He released an open letter to Putin simultaneously with Putin's forum press conference and one day after the St. Petersburg strikes. CNN highlighted the timing. The New York Times described it as a public relations maneuver aimed at U.S. President Trump's attention. Separately, a fire broke out at the Antipinsky oil refinery in Tyumen, Siberia, described in Source 11 as one of Russia's largest privately owned refineries, with design capacity exceeding 9 million tons of crude oil per year. The exact cause remained unconfirmed at the time of reporting. For context, Source 3 notes Ukraine struck at least 21 of Russia's 38 refineries in the prior year. To understand how Ukraine is able to conduct strikes at these ranges and against these targets, we need to look at the evolution of its drone technology, and that evolution is moving faster than most observers expected. Source 10 from The Military Show provides detailed reporting on Ukraine's fielding of rocket-armed long-range strike drones. The primary platform is the Fluorine Monophosphide 2, manufactured by Ukrainian company Firepoint. It is designed to carry a warhead of up to 220 pounds, operate at a range of approximately 230 miles, and transmit live video. In its newer rocket configuration, the drone carries 8 S5 57mm Soviet-era rockets across 2 4 rocket pylons alongside a reduced primary warhead. The S-8, an 80mm variant entering service in 1984, is also being fielded. Its baseline-shaped charge warhead is capable of penetrating up to 400 millimeters of rolled homogeneous armor, meaning it can defeat most armored vehicle protection. Commander Brovdi announced in mid-May 2026 that rockets were being deployed from Ukrainian long-range drones at operational depths of up to 310 miles. And reporting from late May 2026 suggests the fluorine monophosphide 2 has been upgraded to carry a 400-pound warhead at the same 230-mile range. Firepoint co-founder Denis Stillerman acknowledged his company could produce such capability without directly confirming the fluorine monophosphide 2 designation. A confirmed combat application occurred approximately 1 week after the first open-source footage emerged, when an fluorine monophosphide 2 struck what the transcript describes as a strategic communications hub of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Why the rocket armament? This is where the tactical logic becomes genuinely interesting. Russia developed what Source 10 calls a mobile fire group network, armed interception teams positioned along drone approach corridors. This was itself a response to the failure of Russia's electronic warfare layering, described as employing the densest GPS, radio frequency, and broadband jamming environment in modern history. The jamming was effective enough that Ukraine had to find a different technical solution. That solution was fiber-optic FPV drones, drones that carry control signals as pulses of light through cables thinner than a human hair. There is no radio frequency signature for jamming equipment to detect. NATO's Allied Transformation Command formally acknowledged it had no existing countermeasure for fiber-optic FPV drones and issued a formal request for solutions. So Russia adapted with mobile fire groups. Ukraine then adapted with rocket-armed escort drones to suppress those interception teams, while heavy warhead strike drones prosecute the primary targets. Defense industry expert Anatoly Krapchinsky described the resulting model as a coordinated swarm, and it represents a cycle of technological adaptation that is moving faster than either side's industrial base can fully absorb. The naval dimension shows the same dynamic. Russia deployed helicopter patrols against Ukraine's Magura V-5 surface drone. Ukraine then armed the Magura V-5 with R-73 air-to-air missiles, shooting down a Russian Mi-8 helicopter in occupied Crimea in late 2024. The subsequent Magura V-7, fitted with AIM-9 Sidewinder missiles, shot down two Russian Su-30 fighter bombers in 2025, the first time in history that manned combat aircraft were destroyed by an unmanned surface vessel. Now let's turn to what's happening inside Russia, because the domestic picture is as consequential as the battlefield picture. Russia's Federal Security Service conducted approximately 2,000 mobile internet shutdowns per month by the end of 2025, a figure Source 3 characterizes as exceeding the total number recorded globally across all of 2024. Mobile internet was suspended across Moscow for nearly 21 consecutive days in March 2026, with no public explanation, affecting card payments, navigation applications, and ride-hailing services. Authorities effectively blocked Telegram in April 2026 and launched a state-run replacement called Max. But security shortcomings led authorities to again recommend Telegram for frontline military use within weeks of Max's own launch. That is a significant operational embarrassment. On public sentiment, state pollster VTS-IOM recorded stated public trust in Putin at approximately 78% in December 2025. By April 2026, the same pollster placed the figure at 65.6%, a decline of 12.2 percentage points described as a wartime low. The Levada Center's independent February 2026 survey found 67% of respondents said Russia should move toward peace negotiations. Abbas Galiamov, described as a former Putin speechwriter now based abroad, told the Wall Street Journal that a domestic sentiment turning point came in January 2026, the month the Ukraine war exceeded the full duration of the Soviet Union's conflict against Nazi Germany. That is a historically resonant threshold, and it appears to have registered with the Russian public. On the economy, official data cited in Source 3 show Russia's GDP contracted 0.3% in the first quarter of 2026, the first such contraction since 2023, with the Ministry of Economy cutting its full-year 2026 growth forecast from 1.3% to 0.4%. Business investment has fallen to its lowest level since the pandemic period. Russia increased its value-added tax from 20 to 22% in January 2026 and is now allocating 40% of its budget to military and national defense. Germany's Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik assessed that Russia's defense spending-driven GDP growth had effectively stalled during 2024. And the Jamestown Foundation estimated Russia lost between 64 and 92% of its arms export revenue between 2021 and 2026. The wide range reflects two separate analyses using different methodologies and timeframes that the available sources do not reconcile. On oil exports, Carnegie Endowment Analysis reported Russia's oil exports had declined to 3.5 million barrels per day by early April 2026, against a prior average of 5.2 million barrels per day, attributed directly to Ukraine's long-range strike campaign against Russian energy infrastructure. However, in March 2026, Russia's oil export revenue approximately doubled year-on-year, driven by global oil prices rising over 50% between February and May 2026, a price surge itself attributed to the Iran conflict, and by the United States waiving sanctions on Russian oil exports during that period to maintain global crude supply. These two trends coexist in tension, physical export volumes falling while revenue temporarily surged on price. Ukrainian President Zelensky stated in May via Telegram that Ukraine's Foreign Intelligence Service had obtained internal Russian documents indicating one Russian oil company had suspended operations at approximately 400 wells, that Russian oil refining volumes fell by at least 10% in early 2026, and that 11 Russian financial institutions were preparing for liquidation, while another 8 carried what the documents described as unsolvable problems. Source 3 explicitly flags these as lower-tier evidence, attributed solely to Zelensky citing Ukrainian intelligence and not independently confirmed. On manpower, the trajectory is also unfavorable for Moscow. The Economist is cited as calculating approximately 3% of Russia's male population of fighting age has been killed or wounded by mid-2026. Russia secured approximately 11,000 North Korean troops, reported in late 2024, and recruited approximately 1,700 soldiers from African countries, including Zimbabwe and Kenya. Putin amended federal law in October 2025 to permit reservist call-up under the existing Special Military Operation designation and shifted to year-round conscription in January 2026. Peter Dickinson cited intelligence estimates suggesting Russia recruits approximately 25,000 to 30,000 personnel per month, while losing approximately 35,000. That monthly deficit of 5,000 to 10,000 personnel compounds over time, and it explains why manpower remains one of Russia's most acute structural vulnerabilities. Before we move to diplomacy, a brief but important section on Russian information operations, because the disinformation architecture Russia built over the last decade is directly relevant to understanding the current conflict. Source 6 from The Military Show traces Russia's modern disinformation infrastructure to 2014. In July of that year, Russian state broadcaster Channel 1, with a potential audience of 250 million viewers across former Soviet countries, aired fabricated testimony alleging Ukrainian soldiers had crucified a 3-year-old boy in the city of Slovyansk. Independent journalists from Novaya Gazeta and Dozhd found no witnesses, no evidence, and no documentation. BBC News reported that no Lenin Square, where the alleged act was said to have occurred, exists in Slovyansk. The story was eventually traced to Eurasianist philosopher Alexander Dugin, who published a version on Facebook on July 9, 2014, 3 days before the Channel 1 broadcast. Journalist Masha Borzanova located the supposed witness in 2021. At which point she said she regretted fabricating the account. Building on that foundation, Russia's information operations have continued, though their penetration appears to have declined. At the Lviv Media Forum in mid-May 2026, Andriy Yusov, representative for strategic communications of Ukraine's Defense Intelligence Directorate, stated that Russian disinformation penetration of Ukrainian and European information space had become significantly smaller than in 2014, citing what he described as a critical reflex that had developed in Ukrainian society. That's a meaningful shift. But the operations haven't stopped. In the first 10 days of May 2026, more than 21,600 posts advancing an anti-migrant narrative appeared across approximately 14,000 sources on Ukrainian social media, concentrated on Facebook and Telegram. Volume and penetration are different metrics, and while one has declined, the other remains substantial. On the RT side, Margarita Simonyan, editor-in-chief of the Russian state broadcaster since age 25 in 2005, stated publicly in May 2026 that her children had been sleeping in interior, windowless areas of her Moscow-area home for several weeks due to Ukrainian drone activity. This is the same person who stated in 2021 that Russia would defeat Ukraine in 2 days in any armed conflict. Ukraine's security service formally charged Simonyan in 2024, and the U.S. Treasury sanctioned her the same year as part of a response to Kremlin influence operations targeting the American presidential election. Now to the diplomatic landscape, which is defined right now by a widening gap between Ukrainian readiness to negotiate from a position of strength and Russian insistence on maximalist war aims that haven't shifted since June 2024. Zelensky published an open letter to Putin declaring Ukraine's readiness for direct talks, a ceasefire, and negotiations without preconditions at any neutral venue. The timing, as noted earlier, was calculated. It landed during Putin's St. Petersburg Forum press conference, 1 day after Ukrainian drone strikes on the city. Putin's response was revealing. He told forum attendees he had read the letter, but saw no purpose in a direct meeting, characterizing the letter as containing elements of arrogance. He initially referred to Zelensky only as the author and this gentleman, language clearly designed to deny Zelensky's legitimacy. Putin stated that Russia's strategic objectives set at the launch of the full-scale invasion and reconfirmed in June 2024 remain unchanged, and that the complete seizure of the Donetsk region remains the primary military objective. Zelensky characterized Putin's response as confirming the Kremlin's refusal to end the war, and called for a strategy focused on draining Russia's financial resources. Peter Dickinson offered an analytical lens for why Putin won't meet Zelensky that goes beyond tactical positioning. Doing so would confer legitimacy on both Zelensky and Ukrainian statehood, positions fundamentally inconsistent with Putin's public doctrine that Ukraine is part of Russia. Any direct meeting is, in Putin's framework, a political concession before negotiations even begin. David Setter, described as a journalist, historian, and former Moscow correspondent, assessed Zelensky's letter differently, as placing pressure on Trump by taking his stated peace objectives at face value. Trump, when asked whether the two leaders should negotiate without U.S. participation, stated both should figure it out themselves. That answer suggests the administration is keeping its distance from a diplomatic process it isn't controlling. Bloomberg reported that the leaders of the United Kingdom, France, and Germany plan to convene with Zelensky in London to discuss mechanisms for bringing Russia to negotiations. Putin has already rejected European mediation, arguing EU states cannot serve as neutral mediators while supplying weapons to Ukraine. Dickinson assessed that Russia's primary foreign policy objective for approximately 70 years has been to divide Europe from the United States, and that Putin views European solidarity as the primary obstacle to Russian objectives. On the aid and legislative front, the U.S. House passed a bill allocating more than $9 billion in assistance to Ukraine, with the vote recorded as 226 in favor and 195 opposed. The allocation includes over $1 billion for security assistance and reconstruction, and $8 billion in defense loans. Setter assessed the bill faces significantly less favorable Senate conditions and noted Trump retains veto authority. NATO member states are preparing a military assistance package for Ukraine valued at 70 billion euros, with formal announcement anticipated at the July NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey. The proposal is attributed to Germany, and is intended to address unequal financial burden sharing among members. Ukrainian officials stated the funds are sought for air defense capabilities, domestic drone and missile manufacturing, and extended-range munitions. Zelensky stated in his open letter that the war could continue into 2027 and 2028, a timeline consistent with Dickinson's assessment that Putin retains the option of mass mobilization, even as voluntary recruitment falls behind attrition by approximately 5,000 to 10,000 personnel per month. The Senate's trajectory on both the Ukraine aid bill and the Iran War Powers Resolution remains the most consequential near-term legislative variable in Washington. Finally, let's turn to a bilateral relationship that doesn't receive the same attention as the others we've covered today but carries significant regional implications: Bangladesh and India. Bangladesh-India relations remain in a state of unresolved tension following the political transition of August 5, 2024. According to Raheed Dizdar, diplomatic correspondent of Protom Allo, speaking on StratNews Global, Dizdar identified several structural friction points. The most acute is the continued presence in India of former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. She has given interviews to Indian media that Dizdar describes as creating tension in Bangladesh's public sphere, and Bangladesh has filed a formal extradition request. An International Court of Justice verdict has been issued regarding her role in events of July and August 2024. Gray areas persist within the existing extradition treaty, and India's avoidance of the question does not constitute resolution, a formulation Dizdar uses deliberately. On trade, Dizdar offered a piece of data that reframes the political noise around land port restrictions. He cited his own collected statistics indicating 90 to 95% of Indian yarn and cotton imports enter Bangladesh through Chittagong port, meaning only approximately 5% arrives via land routes. Land port restrictions, in other words, carry significant political salience but limited actual trade impact. India has maintained restrictions on transshipment facilities for Bangladesh, which is a more consequential logistical constraint. An ongoing agreement to import 200 rail coaches from the rail coach factory in Kapurthala, 104 air-conditioned and 96 non-air-conditioned, funded by the European Investment Bank at approximately $100 million and above, with delivery expected between December 2026 and December 2027, continues to proceed, with discussions underway on an additional 260 broad-gauge coaches. That project represents a thread of functional cooperation that has survived the political turbulence. The most time-sensitive bilateral issue is water. The Ganges Water Treaty, a 30-year agreement, expires December 12, 2026. Dizdar described urgency for both sides to begin renegotiation, incorporating updated climatic and hydrological data. He identified visa access as the most important immediate issue for India to address, followed by border and water concerns. On disinformation, Dizdar characterized Facebook, YouTube, and blog platforms as having been used aggressively in the 18 months following August 2024 to spread false and inflammatory content, including edited videos. He described social media as one of the most disruptive factors in the bilateral relationship, a structural parallel to the Russian disinformation dynamics we documented earlier in today's briefing. The manipulation of digital information environments, it turns out, is not unique to great power conflicts. It has become a recurring feature of bilateral disputes at every level of the international system. Three themes tie today's briefing together. The first is the fragility of diplomatic windows. In both the Iran case and the Russia-Ukraine case, ceasefire frameworks collapsed, not because negotiations were inherently impossible, but because third-party actions, Israeli military operations in Lebanon, Ukrainian drone strikes timed to coincide with Putin's forum, altered the political calculus faster than diplomacy could absorb. The second theme is technological adaptation. Ukraine's drone program demonstrates that force multiplication through innovation can compensate for asymmetries in manpower and industrial scale, at least for a period. Russia is adapting, but it is adapting reactively. The third theme is information environment fragility. From Russia's internet shutdowns and declining public trust in Putin, to Bangladesh's social media manipulation problem, The management of domestic information space has become a front in every conflict we covered today. Thank you for spending this time with us. That's your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest developments across these stories and whatever else the world has in store.